This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Tony Birch. I'm from the Mundani Ballack Academic Centre at Victoria University, but I'm here tonight on behalf of both the Wheeler Centre and the Yirrumboy Festival, of which this event is part of. The Yirrumboy Festival is going across right across town in the coming week, so there are still many events on, so you should have a look at those on the website and see what else you can catch up with. Of course, to start tonight, we want to give a strong and important acknowledgement to country. In doing that, we acknowledge both the Wurundjeri and the Bunurong people, and of course, all Aboriginal people of the Greater Kulin Nation. We pay respect to all Aboriginal people present in the audience and certainly to their elders and ancestors. I would extend that, though, to you as an audience. Bruce and I are very humbled by the number of people here tonight, and we want to extend our generosity to you as well and your families and communities. Two other things, just a housekeeping thing. Andrew, my good friend from Hill of Content, who always looks after me, is down the back there, and Andrew will be selling copies of Bruce Pascoe's book, Dark Emu, and certainly if you want to purchase those after the conversation, please do so, and we may be able to persuade Mr. Pascoe to sign those books for you. I'm sure we will. And also, if we could just also please welcome our Auslan interpreter, Anna Bost. Anna Bost taught me before we opened up tonight to say Go Blues, and I'll be doing that at the Etihad Stadium this Saturday and every week for the rest of the season. So I want to thank Anna for that, so please make her feel welcome. Our guest tonight, of course, is Bruce Pascoe, and we're discussing in part Bruce Pascoe's remarkable book, Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident, which is this great book here. I spoke to Bruce about this book recently, and in fact we've had, I think, conversations around this book, public conversations, three or four times now. And one of the things that has happened, of course, is this book has taken on a remarkable life and remarkable energy, and it has become genuinely a book, I think, that will change and is changing the way we think, not only about Aboriginal agriculture and Aboriginal history, deep history in this country, but also about the contemporary relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people around the very issues that we're interested in. Bruce, I think, is a remarkable figure because he's a man who I think has done two things, if we can put it very simply, and one is dedicate himself to a project which is about giving value and legitimacy and respect to our culture and our culture in regard to land maintenance and many other issues. But also, I think, in relationship to Bruce's incredible adherence to generosity, to sharing and to involving himself in a process of not only educating people about this important history, but about welcoming people into a discussion that we need to have. We need to have amongst ourselves as a community, as a nation, if we're going to tackle some of the vital issues that are important to us at the moment, including, of course, land maintenance, including Aboriginal sovereignty, and including relative issues that are of importance to us, like climate change and environmental damage. So I think there is no more important time in this country to discuss the issues that are at the heart of this book and are at the heart of what's driving Bruce onward to engage people in the what we might call the afterlife or continuing life of the book. But Bruce, if we could start at the start in a way, and I know I've asked you this question before, but it's an important one. This book, Dark Emu, what was it that motivated your initial investigation into the subject matter and the desire and need to write this book?
My own ignorance, I suppose. I was after I wrote a book called Convincing Ground on the contact wars in Australia, a subject I did know something about, I was getting a lot of information coming back to me from non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal people about other aspects of pre-colonial life, and a lot of that was suggesting an activity that Aboriginal people were supposed to be innocent of, agriculture. And I couldn't believe what I was receiving, the photographs that I was getting. And so I then had to re-educate myself, and I did that by reading a few explorers' diaries, Australian explorers, exploring a country that had been populated for 80,000 years. So that's really hard to do, because when you explore, you're trying to find new places, and if people have been there for 80,000 years, there's nothing new. And in doing that, I was amazed by the amount of reference to Aboriginal agriculture. And so I started to write essays about it. I started talking to people about it on radio and things like that. And the reaction I got was like, people couldn't believe what I was saying. I couldn't believe what I was saying. I couldn't believe it was there. But some academics in Canberra took me aside and told me that I wasn't allowed to say it. I was writing a book for them at the time, and I wanted to use the word Aboriginal agriculture because this is something new that I'd found. And when that book came out, those two words were missing. And I was, I'd been brought up by great parents. Their parents were great people. They were all polite. And they taught me to not make a fuss. So I didn't make a fuss. Wish I had, but I didn't. But at that time when I was told to pull my head in, basically, I then thought, well, the only way to convince Australians about what had happened was to go to the fount of all Australian knowledge, as I was taught when I was at school, and that's the Australian Explorer. So I read all the Australian Explorer's journals, and each of them, even the people who hated Aboriginal people, those who shot Aboriginal people on sight, those who wrote back to their sisters and mothers saying how they despised being near an Aboriginal person, those people wrote in glowing terms about the agricultural system they saw.
One of the things in that initial discovery, or even in possibly certainly the conclusions that came out of that reading, is that you write early in the book about the complete devaluation of not only Aboriginal agriculture but Aboriginal economies and Aboriginal culture. One of the things I'm interested in, because I read some of the same people, to what extent do you think that was in some way a self-conscious decision to admit something else would have been horrifying to the lie of terra nullius, and to what extent is it based on sheer ignorance? So is there a strategic narrative in there as well as one that is simply an ignorant one?
I think there is, and I don't know where we fall off the edge of the knife in that regard, because you could say that most of my school teachers were decent people. Even though I didn't like school very much, I realised that most of my teachers bore me no ill will. They were very generous, kindly. I'd see them down the street. I always lived in country town, so I'd see them down the street. They always were very generous in that regard. And they were telling me that Aboriginal people lived under a piece of bark supported by a bit of stick and just ate witchetty grubs and wandered around aimlessly on the continent. They weren't trying to hurt me. They weren't trying to hurt my intelligence. They believed that because that's what they'd been taught. At some time in our history in this country, someone decided, probably many people, but someone decided that the story of Aboriginal agriculture should not be told to our children. That the people who'd walked into Aboriginal houses and met their 50 other people 50 other people in an Aboriginal house, it's a town hall, and thought that that wasn't worth telling Australians about, has really defied the responsibility of being a school teacher or a university professor or a politician, whoever it was, whenever it happened. That is a disgrace. We're suffering from it now because we're so ignorant of Aboriginal life. We're so ignorant of it and we're so afraid of it that we can't even look over our shoulder to look at some of these plants that Aboriginal people were using and domesticating, and which are so nutritious, which are gluten-free in many cases, which are perennial, which sequester carbon, all the things that our planet desperately needs at the moment. And the law that supported that incredible enterprise of Aboriginal people is another discussion in itself. I'd love to talk to you about Aboriginal law, about the generosity of it, about its sustainability. And these are not, you know, sustainability. You know, I don't want all the Liberals in the room to faint. But it's,
is
you know,
that capital
it's true.
L? Is that capital L Liberals or the small Liberals?
Well,
the small Liberals won't faint.
I thought Malcolm Turnbull was a small Liberal, but
we all make mistakes,
anyway,
Bruce, even
look,
you.
Look, these labels are really unimportant. Mm. It's about a bit of generosity of the heart, not just to people, not just to cultures and races. It's to the land itself, being generous to the land. And we haven't been generous to the land. You know, why did the Darling River run dry 3 years ago? Because we wanted too much from it. We were selfish. You know, why are we worried about the Murray not being able to deliver water to irrigation systems now because we want too much from it? Why do we prevent Adelaide from getting decent drinking water? It's not because we hate the Adelaide Crows. It's because we're selfish. We're selfish. We just take and take and take. You know, when you say you want water in the Murray for the sake of the ibis breeding, you know, people laugh up their sleeve. But, you know, we're a federation of states, and we deny South Australia water. You know, what kind of respect for the earth, what kind of respect for our fellows is that?
Talking about that in relationship to country, there's a quote early in the book which I've actually used in a recent essay. You write, "Few were here to marvel at a new civilization; they were here to replace it." A very simple but deeply poignant, and I think in the end, sad and tragic statement. But one of the things that you know, and certainly comes out in the Explorer's Diaries, there is a real double play here, isn't there? Because in the same diaries and then almost in the same paragraph, you can have an explorer who romantically eulogises Aboriginal people, not recognising agriculture as much, but eulogising and speaking romantically about Aboriginal people and condemning us as savages in the very same narrative. Mm. What's happening there?
I think it's called the human brain because we... I think it's the European brain, actually. I think there's a book in this. And I'm not going to write it about what happens in the European brain. Well, I think we need to go back to first base.
Okay, go back to first base.
When Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas, such obviously rich country, gold everywhere. Unfortunately, a hell of a lot of Indians as well. The Pope decided that he needed. The Pope is a religious figure in Italy. The Pope decided that he needed to rationalise the European approach to these new lands, how they were going to manage those new lands and also how they were going to explain it. And so he wrote a papal bull called The Doctrine of Discovery. And I was able to say this last weekend in the Queenscliff Uniting Church. And the papal bull said, When a European discovers a new land, if the people of that land do not recognise Christ as the Saviour or do not recognise God as the Supreme Being, then it is the responsibility of European people, Christian European people, to take that land from them and to kill those people if necessary. There's a bit of fine print, you can imagine, but basically that's what it says. And that bull was reissued 15 times over the years and explains everything you need to know about colonialism emanating from Europe and extending across the globe. Because there's nothing else to explain how Christian people could be so dismissive of the rights of other human beings. I'm very sensitive about it in my own country, but when I was in Canada at Vancouver, I went to the museum there, and I tell you, it was one of the most abrupt emotional changes of state I've ever had. I thought I was just in for a good day, and I walked into the foyer there, and there were two-storey high facades of Canadian Indian houses, and they were intricately carved. They were just gorgeous, so beautiful, you just could not take your eyes from them. And yet the people who arrived on those shores from Europe called those people savages straight away. If you look at it, you cannot describe those people as savages, but the mindset of the European was so fixed, so determined, so selfish, so avaricious, that the colonial way of treating the situation was, we have to deny these people. You know, we want their land. They've got obviously a sophisticated civilization, but we must deny them. And the only way we can deny them is to call them savages, to call them the heathen, to call them the other. And I had a very embarrassing hour in that, because I hid behind a column, because I recognised exactly what had happened to our people, brother.
Mm-hmm. To take that notion of the European brain a little further, in a sense, to think about levels of inhibition or ignorance, one of the scholars you discuss in the book, Eric Rolls, and linking Eric Rolls to your own work, is that you talk about his point about the very immediate destruction of the nutriment of soil once Europeans bring in wide-acre crops and running cattle and sheep. One of the things that interested me in rereading the book the second time around, I'm interested to... At what point do you think that became known? And because I think what we lived with today is a legacy of refusing even the knowledge that we start to see the obvious, but because people are only hell-bent on thinking about the next year's crop or the next 5 years, they refuse their own insight. So as well as Europeans refusing to recognise Aboriginal knowledge and engagement with country, I think what's happening in Rolls's discussion is that the agricultural community or refuses to recognise its own destructive practice.
They must have seen it immediately. When they dropped the sheep off at Williamstown, the Batman and Faulkner era of Melbourne, they literally threw the sheep off into the shallow water, and those sheep got onto the shore. Presume they shook themselves a bit to get rid of the water, then they marched west, because what they were doing was they were following the Murnong fields of Aboriginal people, and they just marched west. This is an incredibly nutritious plant, but sheep are able to kill it immediately because they crop so close to the ground. They took the crown out of it and that plant dies, but there was so much of it, they just kept on walking west. That's why people ended up in Colac so quickly, because they were following sheep. And, you know, the They saw the degradation very quickly. Isaac Beatty in Melbourne came to Australia, had been told that he would face no resistance in taking up land here, that the Aboriginal people were hopeless. And when he arrived, he noticed that all the hillsides had been terraced in the production of murnong or yam daisy or Microceros lanceolata. The Aboriginal people had these fertile fields of incredible productive capacity, and he noticed that as soon as the sheep arrived, the texture of the soil began to change very quickly. The murnong disappeared very, even more quickly, but over a period of 18 months, the soil was completely compacted so that when it rained, the water ran off. Aboriginal people were seen to be standing in the fields just watching the runoff, and they were completely bemused because it had never happened before. Rain falls, soaks into the friable soil, and yet here they were watching it sweep off this hard pan they'd never seen before. The sheep, one of the most destructive things in Australia, in Australian history, in Australian economy. We used to say in school, we were told to recite it, Australia rides on the sheep's back. Well, we didn't. We were driven into the dirt by the sheep's hoof.
Given that evidence that is so immediate, I think I might know the answer. Why just keep going? Why keep making the same mistake when it becomes so self-evident so quickly that you're doing something destructive? Even for your own society.
Well, I think we're too proud. Australians are so proud. And there's a lot to be proud about. But Australians can't look over their shoulder, because as soon as they start to discuss these things, up until this last 7 years, I would say, and until the last 7 years, we've been incapable of looking over our shoulder and saying, what did we do? What did we replace? And we're having that discussion now, and it's not going to be all sweetness and light. You know, we won't be eating cucumber sandwiches and drinking lovely tea together and rejoicing. There'll be a lot of bashing against each other. There'll be a lot of opinions that we can't agree with. There'll be a lot of bruising going on. And that's just how discussion takes place. When you're discussing something as fundamental as how you use the land. And we need to reform our whole attitude to land use in the country. But we're not going to do it if we can't accept the history. We're not going to understand what has happened unless we realise that Australia, this continent, was taken by force, and that the whole of Aboriginal society was brought to its knees not just by smallpox but by violence of the crudest kind and by hunger. Aboriginal people having been separated from this economic source, the grains and the tubers, were hungry. You know, and I was writing an essay for a food magazine a couple of days ago, and I said that, you know, when Aboriginal people were faced with the starvation of their own child, they would tell a white man anything. So they told white men where the best valleys were. They told white men where the water was, the hidden water, the sacred water. And how can you blame someone who is doing that to save their child? There's so much evidence of it. You know, a proud human being brought to their knees by the cold and hunger of their child.
I want to quote again from the book and then ask a question, and it's relative to a question I asked earlier, but you also write in the book, so little consideration was given to this Indigenous land management that only a few years later Europeans couldn't say who or what had created these prominent terraces. I want to ask you, to what extent do you feel it's a couldn't as opposed to a wouldn't? In other words, a refusal to see or refusal to say what inherently they had witnessed. So rather than base ignorance, again, a strategic decision to silence.
I reckon it's a toss of the coin. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much in it. couldn't or wouldn't. I'd like to make you laugh a lot more than you are, and I could, because I've had a funny life. But this can't be dodged. We, in this country, have kept all this information out of history books for 220 years. It's not a joke. We did it deliberately. And there are some aspects of it where people were prevented from this knowledge through no fault of their own. You know, John Howard was right once in that all the harm that was done, some people are disagreeing that he was right
just,
once.
He said once.
I said once.
He corrected, he just made sure it was once.
Yeah. And, you know, he was saying, we're not responsible for what happened to Aboriginal people before, so therefore get over it, but we are responsible for what happens now. And we in this room are responsible for the intervention, because it happened on our watch. We are responsible for what happens to the refugees on Christmas Island. It is happening on our watch. So there's a bit of couldn't and wouldn't there. But I was... I say in this brilliant book, Dark, Emu, $35.
I've got a novel down there for $29.95.
How do they do it? How do they... But it's deep in our chalk, this attitude to our country, our beloved country. We all love it, eh? You know, sitting out here tonight having a beer, what is it, May the 10th, the air is still warm. It's a beautiful country. And yet we don't acknowledge its real wealth. And we need to readdress all of these things, and we need to acknowledge the fact that we've got a lot of work to do. We can't put it on to another generation. We can't blame the last. We're here. You know, it is up to us to do something about it. And, you know, the sort of things that can be done about it usefully are very, very simple. You know, I was in Geraldton, Western Australia, a few days ago, and I told you this yarn, Tony. A bloke stood up and he was talking about the Batavia and how the first house in Australia had been built by Webby, what's his name?
Yates.
I deliberately forget his name because I don't want to know about it anymore. The Batavia, you know, is part of our colonial history. But he said Webby Hayes had built this house 400 years ago, the first house in Australia. And, you know, I said my grandmother taught me how to be polite. My mother taught me how to be patient. But really, I was exasperated because in the newspaper about 3 weeks earlier, it had been talking about Aboriginal houses of 10,000 years ago, 35K up the coast from Geraldton. And this man says the first house built in Australia. We've just got to get over it. It's wrong. We have to start thinking. We can't blame anyone else anymore. It's in the age. It has to be true. Thank you. Fairfax newspapers are going under, brother.
Yeah, I know.
Apparently. But anyway, it was in a... You know, one of the best newspapers in the land, and this guy, a very prominent local politician, says the first house in Australia is 400 years old. What happened? Didn't he read that article, or did he think it was talking about Malaysians or Africans or somebody? Anyone but Australia. Anyone but Australian Aborigines. That's what's in the back of our mind. That's what's in the back of the European mind. It's dismissing this wonderful culture. And, you know, I've had people say, oh, yeah, but all your people are drunks. No, all my people are not drunks. Apart from Muslim people, the greatest number of teetotalers in Australia are Aboriginal people. When I go and see my aunties, I know I'm in for a rotten afternoon because I cannot get a beer. You know, another cup of tea, yeah, that'll make eight. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's what our mob are like.
And you, as Bruce knows, he doesn't get a beer at my house either. okay. Now, I'm not saying this is a hard question, but you raise, for me, a fundamental issue, because we know that you cannot think about, understand or engage with Aboriginal agriculture without also understanding or beginning to understand that our senses of agriculture or land practice and maintenance are linked to cultural and spiritual values of country. So accepting that the understanding of that from outside an Aboriginal's perspective is limited, let's say that people like, I think, the sort of people here tonight are open to that engagement. How do you begin, or how do we begin to engage people with both that sense of what Aboriginal agriculture is, but what it means in the greater scheme of things about Aboriginal culture more broadly?
We come from the Mother Earth. That's all you need to know. Aboriginal people believe that we rise out of the mother. That's what that statement says. We come from the mother's heartbeat. We all come from the earth. We're all going back there, some of us sooner than others. But and everything that you do to the earth, you have to be prepared to do to your mother. If you're not prepared to hurt your mother, do not hurt the earth, because she is, in fact, your mother. That's the essence of Aboriginal culture and law. It comes up all the time. And yet we despise the earth. You know, we think that we can change it with fertiliser and with pesticide and with river redirection, with all kinds of manipulation of the earth, whereas in fact we should just listen to the earth and try and do the best by her, because the earth wants to be productive. The earth wants to grow food for us. She's always done it. She's always provided for us. There are far too many of us, not in this room, but there are far too many people on the globe. You know, food scientists are saying we can feed everybody on the globe. You know, we've got enough food, we've got enough expertise, enough agricultural science to feed everybody on the globe, but for how long? It is unsustainable what we are doing to water. It's unsustainable what we did to the soils in the Mallee, where they lost 2.5 metres of topsoil in the 60s and 70s. You can't come back from that very quickly. We are destroying soil all the time. So we need to look at the earth and saying, you are my mother. I will not hurt you. I will not hurt you, because I want you to be productive so that your children can be productive and their children can be productive, rather than looking at it short term as if it was a debenture that BHP are putting out next month or something like that. It's not good enough to think of the earth in such short terms. And we will gain from it. We will gain the fact that we'll be able to live here for a long time, because if we don't change our behaviour, we're not going to. And, you know, I know you're probably going to think this is a bit quaint, a bit over the top, but if we looked at what Aboriginal people had done, how they'd used this continent for 80,000 years and sustained it for 80,000 years, there must be some wisdom there. There must be some techniques. And Aboriginal law is all about perpetuity. It is all about generosity. Aboriginal law, the basis is everybody gets fed, everybody has a house, everybody takes part in the culture, and everybody, when they're old, are looked after by the young. It's not utopia. It was practiced here. It was hard wrought. It went through many hands, many generations. Thousands and thousands and thousands of young people were told this law by their parents and grandparents, and they could see its inherent worth and accepted it. That's how you get 90,000 years of culture, whereas the pyramids are 2,000 years old and were destroyed by war.
I wonder to what extent, though, that requires... I mean, and I agree with everything that you've said, obviously. That requires a seismic shift or a greater shift in culture and philosophy as a whole, because one of the things I was thinking while you were talking is that historically there have been Europeans, and talking about almost like a dissenting European brain, where individuals who have been committed to the same protection of the earth as a society has, but individuals, to what extent they are vilified in their own communities, to what extent they are regarded as eccentrics in their own communities. I think of the great Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring, who was such a powerful force in getting the US agricultural industry to stop using DDT. She was vilified for years as she was a spinster. She was never a mother. She was suspect in many ways, including sexually.
Had no fruit in the bowl.
Yeah. Now, it seems to me that what you're asking, it's not only relevant to how we think about country or earth. Western modern society needs to have a seismic philosophical shift about how we operate in all sorts of ways. That's a big ticket issue, isn't it?
It is, and we are not living in the pinnacle of human existence or human ability or human achievement. We are not. You know, we can think that, you know, microsurgery on your brain and your heart and space travel, all of those things, they must be the pinnacle of human existence, but they might just be the very things that bring us to our knees. So we have to be selective about how we use these great inventions, and we have to look very carefully at how we use resources and how we share resources. I see the 8-year-old child as the moral arbiter. When I was in Geraldton last week, I'd never said this to young kids before, but I was so upset by some things that have been happening in Australian life, the selfishness of the banks, the selfishness of individuals with so much wealth and the great separation between the wealthy and the poor, that we seem to accept. You know, Australia used to revere the egalitarian society, and now we're revering corporate cheats, and we don't seem to mind that they get away with murder. I said to the kids, right, you've got 100 people, you've got 100 sandwiches, and you've got 100 apples. How do you divide them? And these kids, 8 and 9-year-olds, they go, oh, well, everyone gets an apple and a sandwich. But our world doesn't operate on the 8-year-old principle. Our world goes, oh, well, I'm working harder than him, so I want another sandwich. He can have the apple. I'll have an apple and 2 sandwiches. That's the principle that our world operates on now. Mick Gatto and company, you know, it's based on selfishness. And our law, our parliament, reveres selfishness. It rewards selfishness. And we have to get away from it. Aboriginal people were growing murnong, yam. Sir Thomas Mitchell saw this, so it has to be true. It went from Garryward, the Grampians, right the way to the South Australian border. He was able to prove that to himself. This is a massive field of agriculture. Went through 4 language groups. The people at the start of it at Garryward couldn't understand the same language as the people at the end of it, and yet they cooperated in preparing this field for harvest. They worked on it together, and they had a law which said, this is how we're going to prepare this field. Now, this is not about capitalism versus communism. This is something completely different. This is about all the people using the land together and each taking only their due. And the administrators of that, unlike capitalism and unlike communism, got only as much as everybody else. It's a beautiful law.
Just on that, though, Bruce, I've got to walk home down Lygon Street, so could you not mention Mick Gatto again? That would be... I've got to get home.
Any wall
anyway,
could fall.
Yeah. We've been talking recently about language, and I know that you spoke about language on SBS recently. So I want to ask not the final question, but close to it. A good friend of ours and a remarkable writer, Alexis Wright, she's recently published an article in Meanjin about language and Aboriginal story. And she writes about how our story, Aboriginal story, has been stolen from us, and how, she writes the quote, has been retold to keep the status quo in place. And that status quo, I'd say, would be some form of colonial relationship. In a similar vein, in the SBS interview you did, you said that the telling and hearing of the Aboriginal story has been perverted and is perverted by the colonial process. Can you elaborate on that comment for us?
Europeans, when they arrived in exotic places, not only took the land, but they also took the culture. And Rudyard Kipling, a great favourite of Europeans, because he talked about such wild things and wild places that our imaginations ran wild, but he actually usurped those stories from the people who had invented them. It might seem an innocent part of colonial rule, but it's fundamental in that the European changes those stories to reflect their own culture rather than to be true to the indigenous culture. And with my own community, Yuin community, South Coast, New South Wales, we've been doing a lot of work on whales, because there's a whale song line which in fact unifies us from Hervey Bay in Queensland to Rottnest Island in Western Australia. This is a song line which is talking about behaviour, about how the world works, how the globe actually revolves, how it's not just about whales moving around the globe through the seas, talking to each other and having a story to tell. It's about the perpetuity of life on Earth. That's the depth of that story. So when we tell that story, we must not reduce it to a story about a lovely whale with big eyes and a charming smile talking to children. You know, that's nice. You know, it's nice for children to fall in love with animals. But it's the adults who need to know that what that whale is doing is he is looking after the ocean. That whale has a responsibility for the ocean that he received when the whale was a land animal. And we need to learn the intricacies of that, because in it are all the things about how we save the earth from damage. It's an amazing story. You can see it in Hervey Bay. You can see it in the 10 minutes from the CBD in Sydney. You can see it at Bermagui, and you can see it at St Helens. It's a massive story. It's one of the world's greatest stories. I might be biased. I think it is the greatest story about care and love of the earth. And it's not a... It should never be trivialised. And I think that we are mature enough as a country to understand that Aboriginal people weren't telling themselves fairy stories, that those stories had immense impact and mean a lot for the earth. It's all about the mother, mm-hmm. All about Mother Earth.
In a moment, we're going to take questions from the audience, so if our mic people can start to move forward. While you've been talking and talking about the mother, it's wonderful to hear we have a young baby in the audience down there joining in. To that young baby, I hope your parent isn't anxious, because we love to hear that sound. It's a beautiful sound, because what we're doing is doing something for your future. So keep speaking up, kid down there. It's wonderful to hear that. Just while people, please get ready to ask questions, just a quick one. I said at the start that one of the things that I think you're doing is you have a very generous capacity to engage people, and you're working with a lot of different communities. How's it going?
It's going bloody well. You know, I think there's a lot of change happening. There's a lot of positivism, and Aboriginal communities are feeling more capable. Mm-hmm. And I think they're also feeling like they have a bit more oxygen than they had 5 or 6 years ago. And I think there's a lot of change going to happen. I've been working on a food project, as have you, with Aboriginal traditional foods. And I'm besieged by young people, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, young people coming down and saying, gee, we want to help you. What can you do? And I said, well, weed that garden. You know, it's fantastic. But we've just got all these young people sitting on the veranda, drinking tea, eating cake, patting the dogs, and all they want to talk about is, what can we do to help you, your mm-hmm. people? And, you know, we get this question all the time, what can we do to help? Well, I think the best thing you can do to help is to get to know Aboriginal people. We are 3% of the population. So every time you walk down this street here and you pass 100 people, three of them are blackfellas, and you should get to know those people. It is not good enough to say, I don't know any Aboriginal people. You see Aboriginal people every day. You must get to know those people. Look, but I went to a meeting at the local co-op and no one spoke to me. Well, because there's 220 years of mistrust. And 220 years of mistrust has to be broken down. And it doesn't get broken down by turning up to one meeting and expecting people to be all over you like a rash. It doesn't work like that. There are a lot of Aboriginal people who have been so deeply hurt, like being taken away from their mother, like having their own children taken from them, so deeply hurt that a relationship between them and a non-Aboriginal person is almost impossible. So you have to accept the fact that a lot of the time you're going to find it very difficult to make that relationship. But time and care and tenderness and multiple cups of tea are a great salve. They truly are. You know, a lot of the people who have asked me that question, what can I do to help? I said, go and ask that lady to come and have a cup of tea with you in your house. And a lot of those old Aboriginal ladies have come up to me afterwards and said, that is the first time I've been in a white person's house. That's the gulf in our nation between black and white. That is the gulf. We do not know each other. You know, and the fact that we do not know each other is why people think they can boo one of the great people of this continent, Eddie Betts, and explain it by something else. Like, with Adam Goods, they said he staged for free kicks. Well, he plays for the Swans. What do you expect? But Eddie Betts, what can you say about Eddie Betts that is wrong? Like, he is a great man. He is a lovely... Oh, he used to play with Carlton. That's something you can say against him. But why is Australia booing Eddie Betts? It's because he's black. And it's because he's proud to be black. So, you know, we can't be all bloody Pollyanna and going, oh, you know, gnash, gnash, gnash our teeth, ring, ring, ring our hands. What can we do about the Aboriginal population? Stop booing Eddie Betts. And when people do boo Eddie Betts in your company, you start to cheer. You start to clap your hands and say, this is the Australia I believe in, and you'll drown that person out. But if good people stay silent, we stay where we are. And the silence of good people has done horrific harm around the globe, and it is still doing it every day.
You just took up 3 minutes of question time.
I thought you'd ask me a question.
Yeah, I did, but I said be brief. But anyway, who's got a question for us, please? Because please keep the questions brief. That would be really helpful. And please keep the answers concise as well. Yes, we have someone here.
Hi. Hi. You mentioned at the beginning that the fellow academics weren't impressed with what you'd written. What's the response to your book from academics now?
Well, the book has been reprinted 13 times since 2014. It's been... well, I did say before, that story came out of the earth. It is not a work of genius. It is just a story that has always been there. My grandmother prepared me to walk past that story. That's all. But the fact that it has been taken up by is because of word of mouth. Australians are talking to each other about Aboriginal issues, about issues that affect our continent and the globe. So it's a new dawn, and we really need to utilise it, because remember when we were going to be a republic and Malcolm Turnbull was determined that we would be a republic, and we didn't become a republic, and that was 30 years ago, and we stopped talking about the issue. Well, the danger for me, and this is what I dread to think about, is that the interest in Aboriginal Australia generated by people like Stan Grant, like Tony Burch, like Gary Foley, like Marcia Langston, like Redfern now, like Rachel Perkins, like all those great warriors, and I could name hundreds and hundreds of them, if that all dissipates, because we're bored, we're over it, we've gone on to the next new thing. There's no new thing. There's only one very old thing, and it's our earth.
Thank you. Next question.
Bruce,
you've got to have the microphone next to you.
Bruce, thanks very much for your book. It's a wonderful book. It changed my view of history of Australia. But given that we're here, and you said we have to take responsibility now for moving forward, I'd be interested in specifically the kinds of things that you think we, particularly the whites, should do. So, for instance, given that cattle and sheep are destroying the land, what do you think we should do with the cattle and sheep that we have, with the cities that we have that weren't here until Europeans came? What should we be doing with those? With the number of people we've got, what should we be doing with the number of people? These are serious questions that we would have to address if we want to get back to Aboriginal agriculture.
Well, if we're going to eat meat, the protein of the land is kangaroo and possum. You know, people are repositioning possums all over the city because they're noisy in their roof. Well, we need to, if we're serious about eating meat, then this is the meat of the country and we need to eat it, because the back leg of a kangaroo, as you know, is rather long and it doesn't compress the soil. This is the perfect country for the perfect animal for this land. We need to change our judgment about it. Don't laud and exaggerate the importance of the kangaroo. It is a wonderful animal. They sleep on my front lawn. Their relaxation is my relaxation. I love the creatures, but if we're going to eat meat, we need to eat kangaroo. The sheep is the most destructive animal on our continent. We also need to grow the foods, the panicums and the kangaroo grass and the things that have these massive root systems and sequester carbon and feed us and require no more moisture, fertiliser or pesticide than the country provides. We need to turn to those things, and we need to be prepared for this turning to take 100 years. If we want it done in 5 years, it means we're trying to drive through an argument, and you can't drive through an argument unless you bring people along. We have to convince Tony Abbott. As obnoxious as that sounds, we have to convince Tony Abbott. We have to explain it to him. Yes, it is like talking to a child, but we have to explain it to him why we need to do this. And Tony will probably never come to this conclusion on his own, but maybe his children will.
Question down here.
Thanks, Bruce. I bought your book and read it 3 times now.
Should have bought 3 books.
I've just been to my primary school this afternoon to be interviewed by students, and I've bought another copy to give to the school. Bruce, it was a revelation to me, like probably everybody here, your book. I read Bill Gammage's book before that, mm-hmm. and that was also a wonderful eye-opener. What is concerning me is I don't hear any of the Aboriginal spokespeople and the people you mentioned talking about this. So you might have answered this before by saying that they Aboriginal people would be like talking to a brick wall telling us about this. We wouldn't believe it. But why don't we hear the building of villages with stone walls, thatched roofs and all that? Why don't we hear that from somebody else aside from your good self?
Well, there are many good selves who are talking about these things. They don't always get the luxury of a microphone in front of their face. But we've all in this country had the same education. And, you know, it breaks my heart to hear my people say, we've been here for 40,000 years. 40,000 years is the absolute limit of carbon dating. That's all it is. It doesn't report the date of an artefact or anything. What it reports is when the carbon molecules have disappeared from that object. And it's a crude instrument. And yet, my people were taught that and they still say 40,000 years. Now, it's not important whether it's 40, 80, 100,000 years. Singh, Sri Lankan archaeologist, was saying 120,000 years. It's not important. But what is important is we say that Aboriginal people were the first people here and the civilization has lasted that long, because no other civilization has lasted anywhere near that long. Pyramids, 2,000 years, wacko. You know, let's have a party. You know, when we're still sending Aboriginal archaeology students to Egypt to study the pyramids, when it was only 3 weeks ago that those 10,000-year-old houses in Western Australia were talked about. There's a 50,000-year-old edge ground axe that was discovered in Western Australia, and we didn't talk about it. There's a grinding stone of 36,000 years in Cuddy Springs, which means that Aboriginal people were the first on Earth to bake bread. There's a village in Western Australia which, when the report comes out later this month, will say that that is the oldest village on Earth. And the oldest village on Earth means that society was invented in New South Wales. These are huge things, and because we've all had the same education, we don't know them. And I said to a mate of mine yesterday, we were talking about something terrible we'd seen, and I said, you can't blame Aboriginal people for not knowing that. You can't blame Aboriginal people for not being able to speak their language. It was stolen. You know, and if smart Alex like me can start recovering language, that's only because my grandmother insisted I go to school. That's all. That woman. And it always just takes one woman, one man, to change everything. My grandmother changed everything.
Okay, we won't be taking any more questions. For those who do want to talk to Bruce, I hope, and I'm sure that Bruce will sign some books, so you might want to take up those comments further. Just a couple of closing remarks. And respect to the last question, there is in fact a lot of discussion within Aboriginal communities around these issues, and I think part of the maintenance of Aboriginal knowledge is in fact the re-education and teaching within communities. So a lot of the hard yards being done by Aboriginal people is within communities, first off. As Bruce would know, and we talked about this out the back, there is a remarkable young generation of Aboriginal people coming through who are doing the very things or addressing the very issues that you've raised there. A young fellow that we've both been working with and incredibly impressed by, young Charlie Solomon. He's a 30-year-old Aboriginal man who's going to do remarkable work, and in a few years' time he'll be taking up the same mantle as Bruce. There are men and women doing this in their 20s and 30s all over Australia. I would mention there is a remarkable Indigenous young group called Seed Mob. If you know, another way of saying what could we do for Aboriginal people, Seed are a group of young Indigenous people who are fighting for the protection of country, fighting for the issues around climate change and environmental maintenance. They're doing it by educating young Aboriginal people within communities, but also linking up and liaising with young people at a wider scale. So one of the things that you could do, go home, Google Seed, go online, look at their website, look at what they do, and do what I have done, and I'm not trying to blow a trumpet, but put your money where your mouth is, give them a bit of financial support so they can continue to do the work. And they're the sorts of things that we're doing. In closing, of course, we want to thank Bruce enormously again for sharing this depth of knowledge that he has. And each conversation I have, I learn so much more. So I'm very humbled by being with Bruce. We want to thank, of course, our wonderful Auslan translator who's done all the hard physical work here tonight. She'll be playing on half forward flank for Carlton next year. And final thing we do is thank our baby down the back. Because when that baby turns 21, at your 21st birthday, someone's going to say, there was a night 21 years ago where you're at the Wheeler Centre, you heard about the future of this country, and it's arrived. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.